This is Coach Caroline Miller with A Better You, and this is the latest in my podcasting series. Today I'm interviewing someone I jokingly refer to as probably my guru. This is Professor Laura King from the University of Missouri, and I call myself a Laura King junkie. Everyone who knows me knows I've been using her work for decades, really. She is at the University of Missouri, but her work has been published very widely, including today in the American Psychologist. Her research has been funded by the National Institutes for Mental Health, and it focuses on, much of it is what is relevant to the question of what makes life good. Laura also received the Templeton Prize in 2001 and has had so many honors that I'm going to let my website list them instead of taking up this wonderful time here where I get to interview Laura. So welcome, Laura.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for agreeing to this. I've been chasing you for months. I'm going to jump right into this. In 2001, there was a wonderful research paper that was, you know, used at the University of Pennsylvania when I got my master's in positive psychology, and it was just called The Health Benefits of Writing About Life Goals. Can you tell me a little bit about what this study found and why writing your goals down may be relevant to your happiness?
Right, yeah. Let me tell you about it. Let me tell you first that, you know, one of the reasons why I got interested in this topic, I had always been studying goals. And in about, you know, in the 1990s, it was a very dominant view in psychology was that if people wrote about their most traumatic life events, that they would have these health benefits. And so lots of psychologists were really interested in this idea that if people write about traumatic, horrible experiences, that they will show health benefits and better well-being over time. And I got interested in this as a goal researcher thinking, is it really the case that we can only benefit if we write about terrible things that have happened to us? Is that if there's something important about writing, why does it have to be writing about something awful? So as a goal researcher, I thought, what if we had people write about their best possible futures, about the things they would hope to accomplish someday? And sure enough, so we did a little study where we asked people to write about the very best things that they could imagine. We asked people to think about their life in the future and imagine that everything has gone as well as it possibly could, and to just share in writing what sorts of things they imagined. And they wrote about those topics for like 3 days straight. And months later, we found out that those people who wrote about their life dreams, which, by the way, was a topic that didn't make them upset, it put people in a really good mood, those people showed the same health benefits as people who wrote about trauma, and they showed enhanced overall psychological functioning as well. So it seemed to indicate that, you know, writing is a powerful, powerful tool. It doesn't have to be writing about trauma. It can be writing about goals, writing about your best possible future. And I think one of the reasons why it works, I'm not sure it works for the same reason as writing about traumatic life events, right, where people are trying to really put words to a trauma, assimilate it into their worldview, and maybe come with some way that they can move on from that. I think when people write about their life goals, they're really putting words to their hopes and dreams. And I think that doing that can really help people sort of get a sense for, how is my everyday life really leading to that life dream? How am I actually doing anything to get myself to this end state? And I think when we write about our goals, we make those dreams concrete. And I think it really helps people to sort of regulate themselves towards the ends that they really want.
So there's benefits in just writing, period. I think I've seen plenty of research on that. But what you did was you took it to a new level and said, write about something wonderful, you know, how your life could be if everything goes as well as possible. And you found that there were even more benefits or similar benefits?
Equal benefits. And although the changes on happiness were really particular to the writing about your best possible self, writing about your future life dreams. And I should say that, you know, it's kind of interesting. I don't know why people fell into this idea that writing is powerful because people were writing about about negative things that had happened to them. And that was really just an assumption everybody had been making, like that's what's interesting about human life is the traumas that we've survived. And we've been, you know, my students and I have done research now showing that there's lots of things in human life that are worth exploring through writing. And negative, you know, traumatic life events are certainly one of them. But we had a study where we asked people to write about even, you know, so what Maslow described as peak experiences, you know, write about the very best moments of your life, those things that you experienced where something really hit you and you were maybe on some other level. And writing about peak experiences is also related to health benefits over time.
Really? Now, if you wrote about those peak experiences, would it be one of those positive interventions that, you know, you would need to change up with something like other kinds of validated personal interventions like exercise? Or do you think writing about a peak experience even just once would have that kind of positive impact?
I'll tell you, we just had a paper accepted for publication that is really challenging, and I don't know why it worked, but it did. We asked people to write about a peak experience or a traumatic life event or a control topic for 2 minutes over 2 days. So they did 2 minutes on one day and 2 minutes the next. I mean, literally 4 minutes of writing. Mm. And 2 months later, those who wrote about trauma and those who wrote about a peak experience both showed health benefits.
Really?
Yeah, I think there's something about opening up you open the can of worms, right? You broach the topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's some, you know, people are taking advantage of maybe some things that are going on subconsciously over that time period. If you know you're only going to write twice, mm-hmm. and you know you only have 2 minutes, I think you're much more likely to stay focused. And after that first day of writing ends, that maybe there's some processing that's still going on, even on a sort of subconscious level,
mm-hmm.
so that they're coming back that next day. They're staying focused on the same topic, which I think is important, and they're showing health benefits, even from such a small intervention.
Wow, I cannot wait to read that.
We call it the two-minute miracle.
Really? Well, I see a book contract coming today. Everyone will want to buy it and read
yeah.
it and know how to do it. Which leads me to kind of a related question, which is, what do you think would be the health benefits of simply listing your goals in bullet form?
I've done so much work on goals, and what shocks me is how often, you know, we know there's a huge body of evidence in psychology showing that people who have goals, and who feel those are important goals, and who really own their goals, who really feel that they are the goals that they themselves, you know, in their heart of hearts, this is what I want to accomplish,
mm-hmm.
that and progress on those goals, those things are so strongly related to well-being and
mm-hmm.
physical health, right? If you're a goal-directed people are doing, you know, having goals is good for you.
Mm-hmm.
But what shocks me is how often, you know, in my research, we ask people to write down their goals. So often people say, oh, I never really thought about it.
I know.
Or, wow, I never even thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder what, you know, what's the missing link there, why people aren't thinking that. You know what? Maybe thinking about where you want to go in life might be a good way to get there. Because there's lots of evidence showing that having goals is a really positive thing. Mm-hmm. I want to say that, you know, one of the reasons why I think goals are such an effective way to enhance people's well-being
mm-hmm.
is because they make their lives emotionally richer, not just happier,
mm-hmm.
but also sometimes more disappointed. Mm-hmm. I think it's so important to remember that goal. The thing about a goal is you talk to people all the time who say, well, I don't set goals because I don't want to be disappointed.
Right.
Or you're at your workplace and you're concerned about something and someone says, you know, you should be more like me. The only reason you're upset is because you care too much. And I think that not caring mentality, that not having goals to avoid disappointment is a really great recipe for a very meaningless life.
Hmm. I couldn't agree with you more, and I'm just going to follow up on that. Have you thought about doing research on just having people, for example, write down their goals and in a bullet form? Or, you know, I have on my website 100 things to do before you die, where you just write 1 to 100. I mean, have you ever thought about just doing an intervention like that and then going back 6 months later and seeing if just the process of writing your life list might make a difference?
Yeah, we have not done that. I have a student who's interested in that, and especially interested in the way that people write those lists. He's sort of interested in when you would list your goals, are you listing the real goals, the ones that you have in your heart of hearts,
mm-hmm.
or are you listing the goals that you feel like you have to do?
Mm-hmm.
And he's just working on the project now, but it does look like people who list goals that they generate by listening to their gut are actually better able to accomplish those goals and show signs of enhanced well-being over time.
That's fabulous.
But one of the reasons why I've sort of hesitated to use a sort of goal listing as the intervention itself is because I do think something like writing that narrative, the story of your best possible self, or the story of a peak experience.
Hmm.
I think constructing a story, I think stories are really, I think, important. They have a lot of meaning involved with them. If you think about, you know, trying to remember something,
mm-hmm.
You know, when I'm lecturing to students, they always remember the stories. They don't always remember the lists. Right? And I think if we put those things into a story, if we think about them in a story form, they take on a lot more power, and they're more effortlessly brought to mind as we're working on various projects in our life.
So are you saying that it might make more of a difference if your goals were constructed in the best possible self-format, all of them, or as many as possible, as opposed to, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7?
Well, one of the things that we've done is to see how if people write that best possible self
mm-hmm.
and then come up with their goal list
mm-hmm.
and then actually ask them, okay, how are these everyday goals that you're working on leading you to that storied happy ending?
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly the case that people whose everyday goals lead to that happy ending are they're more likely to actually enjoy goal pursuit. So they actually enjoy that progress, and they show heightened well-being over time.
That was what I was going to actually ask you about, that research about the conflictual goals and what you found about people who have goals in conflict. Can you tell me just a little bit about that?
I mean, I think it really is important. It's important to keep in mind that you can't be aware of goal conflict if you don't write your goals down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that very first step is to figure out what those goals are. And then it's important to look at them and think about how they relate to each other. One of the very first projects I ever worked on, one of my first publications, was about goal conflict. And what we did is we asked people to list their goals, and then they literally entered them into a matrix
mm-hmm.
so that they could compare each pair of goals and say, do these things help each other or hinder each other?
Mm-hmm.
So is my goal of trying to be, you know, a good wife and mother, how does that relate to my goal of trying to do well at my job?
Mm-hmm.
People whose goals were in conflict were not only more likely to be unhappy, they were physically more likely to become ill over time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's really important. The first step is to find out what the goals are, and the second is to really think about how your goals relate to each other. And if they're in conflict, it doesn't mean, oh, well, you're doomed, but rather, what are some creative ways? Why is it that these goals are conflicting, and what are some creative ways that you might think about, you know, balancing them or having them try to transform that relationship into an instrumental one?
That's probably why people like me do so well in this area, because I do believe you have to literally work with a coach to even be asked what are your goals, because I don't think most people know what their goals are, and they don't know if they're in conflict as a result of that.
Right.
And then, you know, with coaching, then you add in the piece of the accountability and possibly even accountability in a group setting. And I'm amazed at what the power of just this simple work you're describing, what it can do in someone's life.
Well, and if you think about, you know, so many of the things we do, I mean, myself as an academic, right, I don't write a paper and then it gets published, right? It has to go before some other people. Some other eyes need to look at it to give me an objective view of what's missing, what needs to be fixed, what am I not talking about that I should be, and so forth. If you think about, you know, if your life is your most important work,
right,
it's your most important work that you'll ever produce, do you want to produce that life in a vacuum, right? It's nice to have an extra set of eyes to say what's going on and what does it look like from an outsider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also just, I guess, to have somebody active, constructive, responding or helping you capitalize on what is good in your life. If you don't have a list of goals and you don't know they're in conflict and you aren't celebrating what you do achieve, it seems you lose all these opportunities to, you know, promote higher well-being.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's really, it's a fascinating problem, is that, and I think there's actually been some research on well-being therapy showing that one of the things that lots of people need is some help noticing the good things that happen to them.
Yes.
And taking a moment to acknowledge those things. I mean, things happen, and you know, the events that happen to us aren't going to become part of our life story. They're not going to become part of our identity if we don't notice them, if we don't acknowledge them, and in some sense, if we don't incorporate them into the story that is who we are. And it's fascinating to me how often people don't stop and incorporate those positive events into their lives.
And it is. It's sad. And maybe this interview will help people begin to see more of why they need to do it. And that leads me to some of the more recent research, which I guess this is the one that's published today in the American Psychologist, Whatever Happened to What Might Have Been. Tell me a little bit about how do you disengage from goals that are no longer fitting your life, such as you presented at Penn about mothers who give birth to Down syndrome children, and their fantasies about motherhood are all blown to shreds. And I'm looking at all these subtitles here. They're so interesting, The Necessity of Trouble, Surprise, Humility. Tell me about this research and what it means to goal accomplishment and goal disengagement.
Yeah, I got really interested in, and it turns out what happened is after my mother died, I actually started thinking about goal change and how it hadn't occurred to me how much my goals were impacted by this major life event. Mm-hmm. And I had just started my job at Southern Methodist University where I started my career, and all of my goals all of a sudden didn't seem as worthwhile to me as they had been before. And I started really doing some soul searching and thinking about this and thinking, you know, we need to think about the place of goals during life transitions, that a lot of what is taken away from us with significant life losses or big changes has to do with these goals that were giving our lives meaning before these negative or potentially negative events.
Mm-hmm.
And I got really interested in trying to study people who had gone through big identity-challenging life experiences, like parenting a child with Down syndrome or going through divorce after a marriage of more than 20 years. We also collected data from gay men and lesbians, and we're sort of interested in what was the role of goal change in negotiating those major life transitions. And it was very interesting to me. Of course, at the time, I thought I had to find these samples, right, these very specific samples to study these processes. And every time I talk about this work, somebody will come up to me and say, I don't fit into any of those groups, and I've actually never had maybe something happen to me that most people would think of as a major life transition, but I went through this too, right? I changed jobs. I changed careers. And it turns out, you know, I hadn't thought about it at the time, but there isn't a life that hasn't gone through some kind of major change. So I think these goal processes and the way they affect personality development and maturity are really important in a kind of general way beyond these special groups.
Mm-hmm.
So what we found in our work is that we need to think about, you know, a mature person as somebody who has a rich emotional life. They're not going to be happy all the time. I know that lots of people, you know, seek out a life coach or seek out psychology to help them be happier. But part of being happier is also you're going to be unhappy sometimes. That's what makes happiness meaningful and keeps it rich and interesting to us. And what we found is, okay, if you want to be happy, you've got to let go of these goals that are lost causes.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to move on and invest in something else of value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of loss part of the grieving process is really letting go of those goals. And maybe one of the hardest things is to go ahead and embrace something new. You've been through something. You've really invested in a goal. It hasn't worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to say, then what I think the mature person does is somehow admit, this happened to me. You know, that saying that everybody says, you know, if you want to make God laugh, you know, make a plan. Or if you want, right? So you did this really foolish thing, which is you really embraced a goal. But guess what? After you failed, you're going to embrace a goal again. That's the whole idea, I think, of adulthood, is to be able to notice that, my life is going to have some disappointments in it, but what gives my life meaning and passion is this active commitment in what I'm doing, and I'll stay engaged in it and stay in the batter's box even when, these hopes. I've already seen from life experience that it's foolish and risky to really invest in something, but it's worth doing again and again because that's what makes our lives meaningful.
What do you say to people who are stuck and not particularly resilient because their marriage has ended or a child is diagnosed with a very difficult developmental problem?
Right. I think that what inspires me, and I think would inspire anyone, is to look at some of these models of people. And we talk about them in that paper who they've done it. I would remind people again. I'm harping on this. Happiness isn't the only good in life, and sometimes taking a minute to examine loss is a very good thing to do. To embrace that person that you were, who naively embraced these goals and who thought they were a great idea, and to acknowledge the strengths of that person. They had hope and confidence. And they took a risk and they put themselves out there. And all of that is valuable. The outcome maybe wasn't what the person always wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But having done that, having the reason you're disappointed is because you cared so much. I think that caring is a strength that can see the person through to that next level. Once they've healed, once they've processed, and in these, especially in, like, for example, in that divorced women sample, mm-hmm. Time was an important element. I mean, it wasn't about the day after the divorce was final, she was involved in a new relationship and moving on with her life. It was about taking time. And for a lot of these transitions, it's about looking back on yourself after you've had a little space, a little temporal distance to say, mm-hmm. that person was okay. They were naive, and I'm a different person now. And there might even be some things about my life that I regret, mm-hmm. but I'm the person I am because of those things. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to go back.
Yeah. I mean, that's the process of maturity, obviously. But I'm going to throw just a few words at you, and this is my final question. This is in this study as well. You wrote about surprise, humility, and courage. I think you just referenced the courage of being able to face things and move on. Tell me a little bit about what you meant when you wrote about surprise and humility in terms of going through this.
Right. What we're talking about is sort of based on the research that we've done, how do people develop? How do they become mature? How do people move from being sort of relatively simple and in their perspective on life to becoming more sort of wise and complex and understanding of things? And I think, you know, we've come up with these ideas that, you know, the truth is one of the things we need to grow is to allow ourselves to be surprised by life.
Mm.
We can't know everything and we can't expect everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's this tendency for people to want to deny that they've been surprised by something because we think that really smart, strong people should be prepared for anything.
Mm.
Life throws curveballs, and we, as hard as it is, we should be grateful for those moments of surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a good way, you know, surprise is about creativity and engagement. It's a way of getting sort of rebooted, right? If the computer of our head says, whoa,
mm-hmm.
where am I now? What's going on? I think surprise and the capacity to be surprised by life
mm-hmm.
is really about sort of maintaining one's engagement
mm-hmm.
with reality and the capacity to grow.
I love
that.
If we
were never surprised by anything,
mm-hmm.
we would just stay the same.
I feel like you're describing someone who's zestful and childlike in their approach to life.
That's exactly right.
Jaded. I love that. I've never seen that written about. And then humility, just a few words about the importance of humility in this process.
Right. So often when we read these narratives from people who've gone through these major life transitions, there is this admission of being changed.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people want to be able to think about their life as it's perfect, right? It's great, and I'm an invulnerable, you know, tower of strength, and nothing bad that's happened to me has really changed me. And I think that this inability to acknowledge that we've been affected by things is really can interfere with growth.
Mm-hmm.
That we have to sometimes admit that we've been small, to admit that sometimes life has overwhelmed our ability to cope,
mm-hmm.
As a way to kind of get back, ironically, to get strong again, to take our place in the universe and kind of get control over things. I think growth requires some level of saying, you know, wow, this was more than I ever imagined could happen to me.
Hmm.
And I honestly think that it's about developing sort of, people talk about unconditional love, right, for other people, for children, for parents, or whoever. I think it's really coming up with a way to love life unconditionally.
Hmm.
And to be able to say, you know, life will do things to you that you wish would never have happened, and life will do things to you that you'll love.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be extreme joy, and there's going to be sadness.
Hmm.
And staying in with life that whole time and admitting that that's something you love, that being alive every day is worth it, I think is really what, you know, growing, being a mature person is all about.
What a wonderful way to end. Thank you so much. I could ask you a million more questions, and maybe I'll be able to keep up with you by email, but I really appreciate you taking this time to go a little bit deeper into your research and kind of bring it to life for those of us who've been reading about you for so many years. So I really can't thank you enough for joining me.
Oh, sure. It's my pleasure.